today on Vox Talks Economics. Can Europe defend itself? Welcome to another of our special episodes recorded at the CEPR Annual Symposium in Paris. My name is Tim Phillips. Without a US military backstop, Europe will have to defend itself. It has the industrial base to rearm, but Moritz Schulerich of the Kiel Institute and CEPR warns that it isn't converting that capacity into credible deterrence fast enough. When we spoke, we discussed what European rearmament could mean in practice, not just scaling up production, but buying smarter and investing in next-generation technologies that maybe will spill over into the wider economy. But is there the political will to create this European defence architecture? So Moritz, last time we spoke, we were talking about the limits of sanctions to achieve geopolitical goals. And since then, I notice you published an article at CPR. This is your first line. Europe must urgently strengthen its defence capabilities. You're in the FT as well, warning that Germany's rearmament's going too slow. Are we in the era of rearmament? We've gone beyond these economic weapons.
Yeah, we have to rearm. We have to invest more in our own security. And we have to do it fast. And I think economists can help a lot with making that happen. Unfortunately, no one talks to us.
Why isn't anyone asking?
Look, the defense world is its own little universe, and it doesn't come easily to the defense ministries. And I can speak for the German one. I think it's not so dissimilar in the UK and France and even in the US. The economic thinking, the contract design, the question of market design, questions of scaling up, of contracting on capacity and not on quantity. All of these things are not like the day-to-day vocabulary of soldiers.
Looking at some of the things that you've published about this, you publish a discussion paper on who wins wars. And the basic idea of that is economic capacity determines military power, and that determines success in wars.
I think it's one of these papers that actually shows the obvious, but does it in a rigorous way.
Yes.
So that we can actually be sure that the obvious is true.
Yeah.
But it has important implications. I mean, if you look at the current situation where 450 million Europeans, including the UK, are needing 320 million Americans to defend against 140 million Russians, something is off there.
Uh-huh.
And we have the economic resources. Our GDP is about 10 times as big as the GDP of Russia, or industrial production 5 to 6 times higher. So it's really a question of mobilizing them, and then Europe doesn't have to live in fear and uncertainty as we do right now.
The paper didn't start with a surprising hypothesis, but it's kind of difficult to establish absolutely that deep pockets, that military spending does win wars.
Right. So what we do in the paper is the core idea is that we look at conflicts that are happening, interstate conflict wars. If you want interstate wars, you can extend that to civil wars if you want to. And then look at changes of commodity prices in world markets. And if a country happens to be an exporter of a commodity whose price goes up on world markets, they have a windfall gain. And arguably, that increase in world markets, at least if these countries are small enough, I guess in the case of Russia, you would have to look a little bit more closely. But if you have a small country that happens to have an export item that, for reasons unrelated to what's going on in the country, becomes more valuable, and then we can see if that windfall gain helps the country win the war, and the answer is pretty clearly, yes, it does.
We last spoke to Moritz only a few weeks ago in what already seems like a different world, where we discussed his research on what history tells us about how well economic sanctions work, and whether politicians are prepared to impose the sanctions that bite. Listen to our episode, Do Sanctions Work? And if you enjoy these episodes and want others to hear them too, please rate and review us wherever you get your podcasts.
Europe feels a strategic threat that it didn't before. Your answer to this was to propose a European future of defence architecture. Rearmament's pretty expensive and the money has to be spent on the right things. A big part of what you're arguing here is you have to look at next generation technologies. What do you mean by next generation?
What do we know from an economic point of view about how to spend the defence money right? Let me stress at the outset that we're doing this because of security threats. We're doing this because the situation in Europe is much more dangerous than we thought it was on the eastern side. And we're also doing it because our main ally, the United States, on the other side in the west across the Atlantic, is no longer, shall we say, quite as solidly on our side as it used to be. So we have to take our defense into our own hands. And for that, you're right, we have to mobilize quite substantial amounts of GDP. The European countries have more or less committed to spend 3.5% of GDP on defense over the coming years. By the way, that's not an outrageous number. That's pretty much brings us back to the 1980s when we were in the Cold War and we've done this. And defense were part of our daily lives to a degree that we've probably now forgotten about in the last 20 years of peace dividend. Okay, so given that we have to do this for security reasons and we mobilize substantial amounts of money, we should also do it in a way that gives us not only the maximum defense payoff and benefits, but also helps our ailing economies. And I think it's fair to say that most European economies are not in a particularly good shape right now. So how do we do this? Well, A is we have to make it at home and not just import it from someone else. B, we have to make sure that we increase production capacity. So we invest in new plant, new machinery, so we can capture economies of scale. We can make more for a smaller price. And the third point is we have to invest, I would say, both for military and economic reasons in what we call next generation, like the defense technology, the cutting edge, where the spillovers of defense investment for the non-defense industries and non-defense economy are largest. And there are lots of examples in history, from the jet engine to, you know, rocket technologies to GPS, the internet, and even frozen orange juice, where inventions that came from the military have had these applications in the non-defense sector. And if you think about what Europe needs to live in security in the next decade, you talk about autonomous systems, you talk about artificial intelligence, about robotics, about space capabilities, satellite constellations, communication capabilities. You talk about advanced software and hypersonic technologies. You talk about all the things in which the European economies are no longer world class. So there's a chance here to do what's necessary for our defense and to also upgrade our technological and economic base.
And part of that argument is you're saying that at the moment, Europe's armies, they're literally fighting the last war.
I think that's a professional deformation of militaries, as they always think in terms of the last war. I think the UK actually is, at least in its thinking, ahead a little bit. The problem with the UK is there's no money, but at least the thinking is right. In Germany, there's money, but the thinking is not right. And France maybe somewhere in between. Yes. So what's happening right now in many European nations is that the armies, the defense forces order, really pass orders for all the stuff that they couldn't have in the last 20 years. And they wanted so badly in the last 20 years and they never got it. And now they're getting it all and they order it all, but it's not necessarily the stuff they need in the next 20.
Now, your proposal is for a European future of defense architecture, not a British, France, German. Why not national?
Because, first of all, defense is inherently a public good that extends to Europe. And if you want to do this together, you can do it more efficiently if you do it together. You can procure jointly. You can create bigger markets. You can realize economies of scale. And if you think about what's lacking, if you think about defense cloud, if you think about satellite communications, it's just absurd, the idea that every European country builds its own Starlink. You know, we don't need 27 Starlinks. We need one that we can use whenever we want it without Elon Musk shutting it off when he feels so. So what we're calling for in this proposal that you mentioned with Ellen Ray and Philip Hildebrand is to jointly finance the next generation defense infrastructure and public goods that Europe needs. So think about the military cloud that we need. Where do we depend on the Americans? Think about the space and communications capabilities, the European Starlink, if you will. But if you want a European Starlink, you need about, you know, call it 4,000 or 5,000 satellites up there quickly. Mm-hmm. That means you need a lot of launches, you need a lot of rockets, you need a whole infrastructure, a whole ecosystem of production at scale and innovation to make that happen. And so our proposal is we do that jointly, and jointly means a Team Europe. I think the UK and France and Germany will have to be core parts of that, and Italy and the Spanish if they wake up eventually. But it will also be open to the Norwegians, to the Swedes, to the Dutch. It can't happen within the EU for obvious reasons. There are neutral countries. There are countries that seem to sometimes be more on the Russian side. So the EU is not the right frame. And obviously the UK made the mistake of leaving the EU. So that's also an issue that we have to deal with. So it's going to be Team Europe. And it's attractive from an economic point of view because we also have an issue in terms of European capital markets lacking scale and lacking a safe asset. And if we invest 1% of GDP each year for 10 years in common defense, we have a safe asset out there of common joint debt, joint European bonds worth 10% of European GDP. That's a start.
Although the EU can't be at the center of this, can it create policies, for example, in things like R&D that would help accelerate this?
Yeah, I think you would want to get the European research funds, the Horizon and other programs to be aligned more strongly with that objective. And so, yeah, I think the EU will be an important stakeholder. You know, I think the model we have in mind is more like an ESM style, an intergovernmental treaty, an extra treaty that we have to do, an extra organization with the capacity to jointly issue debt for the stakeholders the way that, I don't know, the World Bank and the IMF can do it too. For the simple reason that the EU is, with the 27 plus the UK and Norway, is going to be a very complicated process to get that done. And we need to be quick.
Defence procurement, it literally takes years, decades in some projects. Can your architecture cut through this red tape?
Part of the reason why we've made so little progress despite the war in Ukraine lasting for almost 4 years now, it's really mind-boggling and a big failure of quasi all European states where we are now 4 years in. But let's use the terms legacy defense systems and next generation. If you think about legacy, if you talk about the tanks and partly, you know, the ammunition and all of that stuff and the fighter airplanes and stuff like that, what really needs to happen from an economic point of view is that we leave the artisanal production. It's almost like a handcrafted, right, low unit, high cost production model behind and scale up. That hasn't happened. That hasn't happened for lack of scale because Europe has been not coming together. We haven't even managed to procure jointly, not to speak of like consolidating and producing jointly at scale. So scaling up is the key for the legacy systems, for the next generation, for the autonomous systems, for the drones, for the AI, for the cloud, the rockets and the space technologies. Scaling up is also an issue, obviously. But there it's really about funding the next generation of innovation. And the task and the challenge from an economic point of view is more, how do you get these awfully slow public bureaucracies to fund risky bets on the future at scale in time? And I hate to break it to you, but the people sitting in the defense ministries, the last 30 years have not necessarily led to a selection of the fittest and the best into these jobs because this was not where you made a career. Defense was not a hot thing. The economics literature tells us if you want it quick, if you want it well done, you have to have high state capacity. We're not quite there yet.
You also need money. It's politically poisonous to try and extract large budgets for projects like this at the moment.
Look, I mean, Germany is in the best situation, comparatively speaking, I would say, because there is sufficient fiscal space in Germany. It means the country can avoid, at least in a short run, the classic conflict between guns and butter. So we don't have to cut social spending in Germany to finance the investment in defense and security, at least not in the next 5, maybe 10 years. In the medium to long run, this will have to be financed out of the budget, and then these trade-offs linger. In France, in the UK, the fiscal space is much more limited. Public debt ratios are considerably higher. So debt financing, which makes a lot of sense, by the way, economically, you have a shock, you want to smooth the shock, and you also want to front load the investment because there is a deterrence aspect to it. The more you have soon, the less likely the war becomes. There is an issue here. And again, that proposal that we have, I would say, helps especially the French and the Brits a little bit along the way, because by jointly financing that, a little bit of the burden is taken off their stressed fiscal shoulders.
There still will have to be trade-offs, though. Money that goes into defense will still have to come from somewhere at some point.
the European way of life seems to dictate to always look at the risks and at the negative things. I wish we could shift that to a European way of life that looks at the opportunities. If you ask me, what's the growth impact of that? Is it potentially self-financing? My honest academic assessment would be probably not. So you're right, there is a little bit of a trade-off. But I don't think it's a full trade-off. Not every euro that goes into defense is a euro lost for the economy. It's not debt capital. The best multipliers we have in the short run, the estimates are somewhere between 0.6 and 1.5. Obviously, if it's above 1, then it's a free lunch. If you assume 0.8 or something like that, then we'll get some economic benefit. And especially if we go for R&D, and we're not doing that right now, by the way. We invest a lot of that money, a substantial share of that money in sort of technology research and development. Then we know, Paulo Sorico and his co-authors have a great paper on this recently, that the long run productivity effects can be substantial.
So looking at the urgency for this and the reasons why these decisions really have to be made, we cannot kick this can down the road. Is it the case now that Europe just has to accept that it cannot rely on US help anymore, even if the regime changes?
Look, I think many people knew this and said this, and I was one of them even before Trump was elected.
Uh-huh.
And clearly everyone said it when Trump was elected. And now we are almost a year into the second Trump administration, and I think it's become very, very clear and obvious to everyone that certainly this administration does not see Europe as a friend. We are internationally what California is domestically. We're the we're the liberal idiots who believe in, you know, who right. believe in universalism. If you look at the new national security strategy, it makes it blatant obvious. You can make the argument that the US is seeking regime change in Europe. I pretty much say that in openly in the national security strategy, that what they see right now is not what they like, and they want to support the guys who want to change Europe. And that's not a good thing. There's a difference even here between the US and China. China doesn't want regime change in Europe.
Is NATO permanently undermined now?
Look, the smart people who are not in this camp, who are not in the Team Europe camp, and I would consider myself to be in the Team Europe camp, it says like, yes, we know going off our addiction to the US backstop will make us weaker in the short run, but it will ultimately make us stronger. The people who say this is not a good idea point to the fact that, of course, in the short run, the European dependence on American, what they call strategic enablers within NATO, so airlifting capacities, intelligence capacities, command and control systems, European militaries cannot talk to each other. They need the Americans to talk to each other. That getting rid of that is costly, difficult, and in the short run weakens the defenses of Europe. So there is a very strong, especially in military circles, a very strong drive to hope for the best that after 2028, America will be America again and everything can go back to normal. And I think that's negligent and dangerous.
If we're spending trillions on defense, what are we spending it for? Are we not rather overestimating the threat from Russia? Are there other imminent threats to Europe's sovereignty?
If Europe decides to spend 3.5% of GDP on defense, I'm making a very rough calculation here. Europe's GDP is around 20 trillion. We'll be on track to spend 700, 800 billion a year on defense. That's 50% more than Chinese defense budget. Mm-hmm. It's close to the American one. That's six times more than Russia. That should be enough. If we do it efficiently, if we do it jointly, and if we do it the right way.
But might it be too much, though?
Look, I mean, there's some catching up to do because we've underinvested in defense. So to get to a steady state where we are in a position of being credibly deterring and hence making war less likely, we probably have to front load a little bit. 700, 800 billion doesn't have to be the steady state number, but I think it's necessary in the short run to gain that strength and independence that makes war in Europe involving the EU unthinkable. And I think the very simple comparison is like, why would no country in the world have the idea to attack the United States? Because it's suicide. Europe has roughly the same economic potential, the same technological capabilities, the same economic size, the same resources, the same financial resources. And we live in fear and are weak. So it's our decision if we want to be strong. You're right. We don't have global ambitions. We probably don't want to control the Pacific. So we can, down the road, possibly spend less on defense than the Americans can. In the short run, I think it's necessary to ramp up our spending. But also, we have to be smart about it. I think the question that people have is, what exactly are Dutch troops protecting in the west of the Netherlands right now? Mm-hmm. Why aren't European troops stationed in Poland, in the Baltics, instead of Italy, Portugal, and Spain? It gets even a little bit more absurd. You know, we need the Americans to defend Europe mostly because we need the Americans to airlift European troops from one part of Europe to the other. You might ask, why do we have lots of soldiers in France where clearly the threat to France does not come from Belgium? As economists, we also have to ask ourselves, why have we been asleep at the wheel? There's a very little research on defense economics. Uh-huh. It's the largest expenditure item in many countries now. And why do we know so little? So CPR is in the process of setting up an RPN, a research policy network in defense economics now. But it's definitely an understudied field. There is a whole universe of questions that right now we're not very well equipped to speak to. So we need to retool as well and urgently look at these things and give advice to policymakers, because that is also, I think, our responsibility towards taxpayers, that at least we tell the defense people, this is how you can do it efficiently. This is how you create markets today for the innovation of tomorrow. So it's an exciting field, unfortunately a little bit depressing, but nonetheless probably the area where economists can, being economists gets most bang for the buck right now.
What is the scenario that you're afraid of?
It is a scenario where there is some kind of dirty peace in Ukraine because Trump and his team throw Zelensky and Ukraine on the bus. The Europeans are not strong and united and fast enough and decisive enough to support Ukraine militarily. And in that scenario, the Russian economy that has switched to a war economy and produces equipment, armament, munition, tanks, planes at a high speed, much higher rate than Europe does right now. Within a reasonably short period of time, a couple of years, Russian stocks of tanks, of military equipment, become really quite large and look quite threatening. And what Moscow might do then is what they did before in 2014 in Ukraine, just nibble away a little lake in Lithuania or a little town in Latvia and see what happens next. Whether the Europeans and the Americans are really willing to wage a full-scale war against Russia to defend a little lake in Latvia. And I can tell you right now what the answer of the Trump administration will be. Will be no. And if then we don't react as Europeans, and Putin and on Moscow or whoever is in charge there understands that the Article 5 commitment of NATO is not unconditional, that it's weak and unclear, the European security architecture has broken down, and from that moment on, NATO is dead and Putin is re-establishing some kind of Soviet zone of influence over much of Eastern Central Europe, which is what these countries and I think the rest of Europe do not want.
Thank you very much, Moritz.
Thank you, Tim.
Read more about this in the Vox EU column, European Defence Governance and Financing. It was authored by Philip Hildebrand, Helen Ray, and Moritz Schulerich, and was published on the 20th of November, 2025. And also the discussion paper, DP19841 from CEPR, called Who Wins Wars? The authors of that, Jonathan Federle, Dominic Rona, and Moritz Schulerich.
Vox Talks Economics is a Talk Normal production. The assistant producer is Megan Bieber, and our editor is Andrei Zagarian. Next time on Vox Talks Economics, could stablecoins crash? And who will pick up the pieces if they do?